Welcome to episode 113 of the Golf Rules Questions podcast. Fantastic guest on today, Mr. Trevor Herden, who currently is the tournament director of the Australian Open and other Golf Australia Championships. He was in charge of the PGA Tour of Australasia for many years, including taking the position only 6 months into the job, and we'll hear more about that and a couple of rulings that he had with Greg Norman and Nick Faldo. It's been a fantastic episode. I've loved every minute listening to all his experience that he's had in running golf tournaments, you know, starting out as a referee, but more so taking over the top job and looking after the Australian Open, which has grown in size, now has men, women, and all abilities players playing over the 4 days. Trevor's been a fantastic guest and well worth the listen to. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. But just before we get into that episode, I want to encourage you that if you like these podcasts, please share it with a friend or two. Send them a link and get them listening. As well as the podcast, Stuart and Blakey also produce The Drop Zone, which is a weekly rules newsletter that gives you some helpful hints, a few rules questions, and there is usually a funny video to keep you entertained and educated. So send us your email address if you have yet to sign up. And when you receive the newsletter, make sure to forward that on to your captain or manager at your club. They are free to distribute it to all of their club members. We also have merchandise that you can purchase so that you are representing the best Golf Rules podcast in the world. Grab a t-shirt, a hat, or even a hoodie featuring the Rules Roo or the Wombat Caddy. And now, whether you're in your car or going for a walk or just taking a break after mowing your lawn, enjoy this episode of the Golf Rules Questions podcast.
Oh, you see referee David Blake there. He's obviously talking to one of the rules officials up by the green.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Golf Rules Questions podcast. This is episode 113. I am Blakey, the usual suspect. And with me, I have an absolute honour it is to have Trevor Herden. You've got so many titles that you've done, so much experience. It's pretty hard to nail exactly what you haven't done. It's probably the smallest list is what you haven't done in the world of golf, Trev. But we'll get into that. It's fantastic to have you here beside me.
Pleasure.
We'll get into that in a second. I'll just knock out the GRQ OTW from episode 112, which was about Andy. His ball was on the front of the green for four, and he had water on his line of play. And because he's on the green, he gets relief, free relief.
Yep.
Worked it out on the arc, worked out his nearest point of complete relief, and he was supposed to place it, took a drop, and played it from there four more shots. So he gets the two extra penalty strokes, and you can find that as a clarification under 14.2B2/1 when a player drops a ball instead of replaces it. So 10 there, and Roon got that one right. Andy, the average golfer, had 10 shots. But enough of the GRQ OTW.
You're right.
Episode 113, I've got Trevor here. First of all, tell me, or tell the listeners who you are and what you're currently involved in at the moment, and then we'll do a deep dive in what you have, or as I said, probably what you haven't done is a smaller list.
Well, I'm currently tournament director for Golf Australia for the Australian Opens and a number of their national championships. I also help out the PGA with some of their events, so I'm still quite active, very active in fact. So we're trying to work out the Australian Open for this year, which we should know later on this week. So I've got plenty to do and enjoy doing it as always, and I've been doing it a long while, as you say. It's been a privilege, and golf's been good to me. Hopefully I've been okay for golf too.
Well, how did you get to where you are? So you're basically TD for Golf Australia, look after their all their major championships. How did you get here? I mean, that's a lot of experience you need, knowledge you need to get there. Where was the first golf involvement back in the day?
Well, I never played golf. I left Australia when I was 20, went to New Zealand into Dunedin, and I started playing when I was 27, and I got down to three, which was a pretty good handicap for me, I thought. But I ended up managing the Otago team in Dunedin. So I did that for 2 years, and then I left Dunedin. My marriage fell over, and I was coming back to Australia. And Greg Turner had just got his European tour card, ran second to Elazabel. And Turner said, well, look, if you're going back to Australia, would you like to caddy for me? I'm going to play a couple of tournaments in Australia. I said, sure. So came to Melbourne, ran second the first week at Yarra Yarra in the Vic PGA Championship, and then ran top 20 in the Australian Masters the week after. And after that event, like, we'd gone pretty good for the two weeks. He said, you fancy coming to Europe with me? I need a caddy for Europe. So I said, why not? Yeah, sure. So I went to Europe, went with Greg around the world for 3 years. It was fantastic. We won in Scandinavia. We had a lot of, you know, top 10 finishes. We played great. He was a great player, Greg. And near the end of that tenure, I was offered a job with the PGA Tour of Australasia. They said they were looking for an assistant tournament director. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, I would be. So they said, right, we'll go and have an interview. So I went. I was going back to London. They said, well, if you're going to London, we'll line up an interview for you in London. So I had a meeting in London. And they said, you've got the job. Can you start in July? And I said, well, yeah, sure. So
what year was this?
That was 1989. Okay. 89. So I did that, and I started. I worked under a gentleman by the name of Graham Nightingale. And I worked. I got in there in July, as I said. And then in December, he resigned. So I'd only been doing this for 6 months, and I hadn't been, you know, into rules very much at all. I worked out a fair bit about, you know, setting up golf courses and that, having caddied a number of events.
Yeah, with Greg. And for those of you who don't know, predominantly my audience is American and Australian. Greg Turner, amazing New Zealand golfer, and he played predominantly in Europe. Did he ever go to America apart from sort of majors?
Yeah, we got invited because we won Scandinavia. We went to the World Series at Akron.
Yeah, okay.
Went there. Went to a few other good events.
Yeah.
Didn't have great success in America, but that experience was everything at that young part of his career, early part of his career. But
So pull it back to now, December 89, your TD, and how many tournaments would the PGA Tour of Australasia have back then?
Oh, back then we had about 11, 12.
4 days.
Yeah, four days, yeah. So when my superior resigned, I was running the Queensland Open with the Golf Association up there at Royal Queensland.
Okay.
And I found out that he'd just resigned. But unfortunately, the next big event, major event, was the Palmetto's Cup.
Okay.
At Palmetto's on the Gold Coast in 1990.
Yep.
Well, that was turned out to be the biggest thing ever, because it was the biggest purse and it had the most amazing field with Floyd, Faldo, Langer. It just had the who's who, Curtis Strange, had everybody. And at the end, I don't know whether you knew that, but I actually had to disqualify Norman at that very tournament, my first tournament as tournament director in charge of the whole thing. And I've got to take out Norman, who broke the course record the day before.
On the Friday,
he breached a rule for dropping in the wrong place, picking up a ball in play and dropping it in the wrong place on his 10th hole at Palmetto's. And I find out at 11 o'clock that night that this has happened because somebody's watching the highlights. So the next day I've got to...
This is back then. If you break a rule, sign your scorecard, hand it in.
Yep.
You were done. There's no, I'll just add your penalty that you didn't know of.
Correct. So that was the most amazing day in my career. So,
hang on. Your boss has resigned while you were doing a tournament, and was it effective immediately?
Well, that was his last tournament. That was the last tournament before Christmas.
The Palmetto's. So he...
No, that was in January. Queensland Open was the last one in December.
Right.
So I've got to go through Christmas...
Organising this
tournament, being in charge of it, getting everything sorted that I hadn't really been involved at before because I've only been there for a few months.
And who was the backers of that one, the Palmetto's Cup?
Daikyo.
Okay.
They were sponsors.
Yeah.
But quite an interesting story with that, like the disqualification was big enough, but the circumstances around and what followed I don't know whether you'd want to hear what happened.
Go.
There.
Go.
Okay, so I hear
that. Hang on. So Thursday he shot whatever. Friday he broke the rules. Saturday he shot record.
Friday he shoots the course record.
Oh, Friday because
breaches the rule.
Okay, right.
I find out Friday night. On Saturday morning, having had no sleep all Friday night, I've got to go back and see the TV first thing in the morning and have a look at the footage to make sure that what I'm hearing is correct.
Right.
So, sure enough, I get down there and I'm looking in this, and he's dropped the ball within two club lengths out of the penalty area.
Yeah.
He's dropped it. But the ball's rolled to a position where his feet were inside the red line of the penalty area. Now, he assumed that it was the same as ground under repair.
And you have to take complete relief.
Which is not right, because as long as the ball doesn't go. So now he picks the ball up in play, drops it in a wrong spot, and plays, and outside his scorecard. End of story for poor Greg. So now that next day...
And he was leading the tournament.
Playing in the last group at 12:30 with Ray Floyd on Saturday. So now I've got to wait for Greg to rock up at the tournament on Saturday morning. And up comes the white limousine with Greg in it. And I meet Greg at the door of the car. I say, Greg, I'm Trevor Hurden, tournament director. I said, you won't know me. He said, oh, hi, Trevor, how are you? I said, good. I said, I just need to ask you a question. He said, sure. Anyway, I explained what I'd heard. I asked him to go through it. I said, I'd been to TV. I'd watched over the footage for some number of times.
Yes.
I said, no, I'm 100% sure we've got an issue here. He says, well, isn't the rule that you've got to be clear with your feet? And I said, no, it's not ground under repair or taking relief from obstruction or where you've got to take total relief. I said, as long as the ball doesn't roll back in or near the hole or et cetera, et cetera. I said, you know, it's in play. Then you've picked it up and you've played it from the wrong place and you signed a wrong scorecard, wrong score. Oh, he says, well, what's the penalty? I said, well, it's disqualification. He said, really? I said, yeah. He says, well, this is his very word. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I'm going to go over to the range. I'm going to hit a few balls. He said, you just go and make sure that you're 100% right. I said, okay, Greg, I'll do that. Thank you. Off I go again back to the TV to make one more check. And at this point, I get the promoter of the tournament, who was Terry O'Donoghue, who's got done this amazing job. Now, you've got to think about this. This is on the Gold Coast. At 12:30 in the morning, the Gold Coast is loaded. Palm Meadows is loaded. They've had a champagne breakfast on the Saturday morning for all the people that have got tickets, and it's full on.
Because this is Greg Norman, end of the 80s,
world number one
in Australia. This is
course record the day before, leading the tournament, the biggest tournament in Australia, and it's on the Gold Coast. And Greg's a Queenslander, so I go back to the practice range to see Greg. I said, Greg, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to disqualify. He says, right. He says, well, we're going to do a media conference. So away we go. I get Greg in the car, and I drive past this fence through the car barn down to the media centre, right? And all of a sudden, everybody starts saying, he's disqualified. He's disqualified. And how they got wind of that, I'm not sure, but somebody might have said something. The caddies may have said something about it. Anyway, cut a long story short, we go down, we do this press conference, and I've got to take my hat off to Greg. Greg was fantastic in the press conference. He at no stage did he ever try and be someone that he shouldn't have been. He accepted it. His words were that I'm no bigger than the game, and if I've done wrong, I've done wrong, and Trevor's, you know, he's got a job to do, etc. It was perfect. It was very good. So as bad as it was, and it was all these TV cameras, the Japanese TV crews that were in the back of the media centre, it was... Seriously, there must have been 50 cameras. It was really quite significant. Anyway, I know this is a long winter, but it's quite interesting. So now I'm driving back, taking Greg back to the range to get his caddy and everything. I take him back. Now the spectators have turned on the tournament office because they all want their money back. Wow. And they pulled the fence down behind the first tee. They were going nuts.
Wow. Right.
So this was quite... So Greg got out of there. That's fine. So the next dilemma I have that day, out of all of that that's just happened, is I've got Ray Floyd standing on the first tee with no one to play with. So what happens? I look over on the range at the far end, and Hank Barron, You remember Hank Barron?
Yeah.
Hank Barron, American, had missed the cut. He was there doing some chipping at the end of the range. I went over to Hank and I said, Hank, can you do me a favour? He says, sure, Trevor, what do you need? I said, I need you to play in this last group with Hank, with Ray Floyd. He says, you off your head? I said, I've just had to disqualify Greg Norman. I said, I can't have Ray Floyd walking around there with a walking scorer.
Wow.
So would you mind playing with him? I said, I'll pay you $500 if you'll do it for us. He says, Trevor, for you, I'll do it. So Hank Barron played that round with Ray Floyd.
Wow.
So that's what happened that day. And that was my first tournament in charge in Australia.
My God.
So how's that for a start?
That is it. So basically there were just two, there was just a TD and an assistant TD when you started.
Yeah, and four rules people.
And the rules people usually came from the state association.
Or the PGA. Yeah. They weren't full-time PGA staff or anything.
Just doing some part-time casual work.
That was it.
Wow.
That was my first
initiation. Then obviously, it was a January, and then you probably had another five lined up after that.
Yeah. 1 year we went straight through. We did nine straight before Christmas.
Wow.
But that was a big week in my life.
You had so much going on. You're probably just trying to get this out of the way. And, you know, every different state that you went to, you're getting state association people or PGA people to come and help referee.
Correct.
But then were you also looking for someone else at the same time?
Well, we had a bit of a – we did talk about that. And then we used to – Andrew Langford Jones, who you know.
Yeah.
He ended up helping us out at quite a few events. He became very good at it. And as you know, when I went to America, Andrew took over. So, so it was a good transition, and he did a very good job. He was keen to learn, and he learned well, as we all did.
Yeah.
But we had to learn quickly.
Yeah.
You know, because I'd just come from caddying straight into it, and the tour back in those days hadn't prepped anybody or did any planning for really much at all. The other reason they got me was that the tournament director was doing too much travel, and his marriage was suffering somewhat.
Yeah, right.
So that's why I got involved, asked to come join them. So that's what happened.
How were you learning your rules along the way?
Well, when I first went to that tour office back in the July of 89, my Mr. Nightingale said, there's a rule book, son. He says, I want you to just learn all you can in that rule book. And he faced me into the sun, the western sun, at Hornsby PGA office.
Yeah.
For like 2 months before the Q school, and they made me read that rule book every day.
Wow.
And that's all I did.
Yeah, wow.
Oh, mate, it was a steep learning curve, I'll tell you. But anyway, it's as it turned out, and we've had some interesting stuff happen since then, of course, with Faldo and...
Well, you were just, before the podcast, you were telling me the Faldo. Do you want to get into that? So what year was the Faldo rule?
I think that was 95.
Okay,
that was the Asian 8 Alfred Dunhill Masters in Bali.
Was that a co-sanctioned thing?
It was with the Asian Tour.
Asian Tour, and because that would have been, actually that was when the Asian Tour started. Before that there was
Asian... Oh no, the Asian Tour started before that.
Asian PGA, and then they went to Asian Tour, right?
Well.
I think that was about 95 or 96.
Well, it might have been, but it's a while ago now, of course. So the Fowler's scenario was... Nick Faldo, as you know, was a major player. He's a major winner. He'd done everything, but he found himself in the doldrums a bit over a period of time, and he was just coming back, and they invited him to play. He had an arrangement with the Alfred Dunhill people, sponsorship deal. Anyway, he came out down to Bali and was playing in the tournament, and in the first round he'd played with Michael Campbell in the first round. Anyway, apparently they were on the fourth hole, and he'd hit his second shot into a bunker. He'd moved a piece of coral out of the bunker because it was a loose impediment. Now, he was playing in Europe most of his time, and they had a local rule introduced where they could move loose impediments. But the rest of the world, you can move loose impediments out of a hazard.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Out of a bunker.
Yeah.
But the rest of the world hadn't adopted that.
Right.
Including Australasia.
Wow.
Now, there was no European Tour local rules involved in this tournament. So Faldo's picked up the piece of coral unbeknown to anybody, and thrown it out of the bunker.
Just thinking because he plays on this other tour that it's just a rule of golf.
It's just a rule of golf.
Even though it's completely local to that local tour, and now it's gone around the world. Yeah.
So
wow.
So Nick plays great that week, and he's playing fantastic golf. And matter of fact, he's leading the tournament by 4 shots. playing the 15th hole, I think he was. And I get a call to go to the scorers area and meet Craig Parry urgently. So I race down, wondering, because as a tournament director, you never know what's going on.
Yeah.
You never know what's going to come
especially
out of the radio.
When it comes to the scoring team.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen. You never know what's coming out of a phone.
Yeah.
All this. So I raced out there, Craig Parry's there. I said, what's wrong? He said, well, look, I've just played with Michael Campbell. He said, and I was going to move a piece of coral out of the bunker. And he said, yeah, it's fine to go ahead because Nick Faldo did it on the first day on the fourth hole because Cambo was playing with him. And he says, we can't do that because it's not a local rule. And I said, well, that's right. He said, well, Faldo's done it on the first day. So now I've got this dilemma again. Here I am. This guy's playing great. Looks like he's going to win the tournament. And there's every chance I'm going to have to disqualify him for breaching a rule that he had no right to touch a loose impediment because under our hard card, with our hard card and local rules, nothing in there about moving, you know, loose impediments out of bunkers.
Yep.
So Nick just tees off 16 when I get back up to the top of the hill. He gets up and I said to Nick, I said, I've got to ask you a question. I said, can you tell me on the first day when you were playing with Michael Campbell, can you tell me what you did on the fourth hole? And he explained, he said, I hit my drive and I hit my second shot into a bunker and I threw a piece of coral out because it's a local rule, you know, we're allowed to throw stones out of bunkers and all that. And I said, well, we're not allowed in this tour because it's not a local rule, an Australasian or Asian tour. He says, you're kidding. I said, no. So again, he asked me what the penalty is. Is it one or is it two? Well, I said, well, Nick, if you've signed for that scorecard, I said, it's disqualification. He said, you're kidding. No, I'm not kidding, Nick. And I'm 100% sure there's that because I've obviously spoken to Campbell and got all the facts and everything. I said, Nick, we're going to have to take you out of the tournament.
Yeah.
So he's absolutely devastated. He's going to win his first tournament that he's won for probably 3 years.
Yeah.
Right? He's played a whole heap of golf and not done very well. At all, missed cuts everywhere. Really hit the wall with his performances. Anyway, I put him in my golf cart and I'm driving back up to the ball towards Fanny. You might remember Fanny Sunderson, his caddy. She's up at the ball in the middle of the fairway at 16.
Yeah.
And I drive up with Nick and she says, what's going on? And he says, pick up the ball, we're disqualified. What for? She actually put an expletive in there. Anyway, we're driving back to the media centre. She's crying. Nick's going off. He says, I'm going to call it a win anyway. And well, like there's all this stuff happening. Oh, so that was another major incident in my relatively short career there at that time.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was another story.
Do you have any others? Any other? I mean, you know, we can go out and be referees, and I had one the other day in Hong Kong, which people know about. But, you know, when you're at the top and people suddenly, those guys, if I've got a TD, I can always just go, oh, what do you reckon? You know, but you are the top.
Yeah.
How many times do people come to you and go, oh.
Well, I guess the bottom line, the way I've always thought about it, which I think we should do, is we've got to protect every one of those players that's playing. You've got to do the right thing.
Yeah.
You've got to protect the game. You've got to look after the game. You've got to look after your field. You've got to look after the sponsors. The sponsors want the right outcomes.
Yeah.
You know, so there can't be anything, you know, that's not right.
Yeah.
As long as you've got the ability to do it and, you know, protect everything, you've just got to do it.
Yeah.
As difficult as they are, those moments, and as, you know, chronically, you know, disadvantaging somebody like that, and poor old Faldo, I felt so sorry for him because he was making his way back from a really poor time in his career. But anyway, it's just life, and it won't be the last time it happens.
Yeah,
sad.
So Trev, you've done your rules, and there's the rules side to, you know, being a referee, running a tournament, but you know you're far past that and have far more experience with actually running a golf tournament. So where does it actually start? where, you know, does it start a week out and you just turn up and you set hole locations?
No.
Or is there, you know, how much more to running an actual, especially like the Australian Open, which is, you know, the national open?
Yeah. Well, you basically start 6 or 8 months out from drilling right down into it, into the nitty gritty. And, you know, first of all, you've got to, I always believe that you've got to have, your number one priority is to look after the players and the proper playing of the game. Right? I think that's priority. You can always get players, but you've got to have a golf course. What type of course do we want them to play? How difficult do we want to make it? How difficult can we make it? What's the growing conditions like at the time we're playing it? You've got to have proper play carried out. You've got to look after sponsors, players, TV, all these pieces to the puzzle. So if you do tick all these off and get them right, you're a long way down the track and getting a successful event. You know, and if you then you go, you step outside that for a moment and remember about your TV, which is, you know, unbelievably important TV. Then you've got to involve the club and you've got to get your volunteer base and you've got to get everybody that's got a role to play in volunteer land. You've got all that. And you've got security. And you've got, like, there's all these layers of people that you need. Your transport, player transport, or public transport. All these things. So it's layer upon layer. So you want to, even though you might not be totally in control or in charge of every one of those specific things, it's your job to oversee it and tick that box. So you're happy with what's going to be planned and the functionality of it. And if that works and works for you, you know, ultimately it's on your head because the players will come back straight at you, or the parents of players or relatives, or somebody will come back and have a crack at you. But it's got to be right. And we're very lucky. We've had great success. A lot of good people involved in tournaments. Australia has great tournaments. We have great golf courses. We've got great depth of players, fantastic TV coverage compared to a lot of other places. So we play well above our weight in that regard.
And it was a lot easier when it was just the men's Australian Open played by itself. You had a lot more choices of golf courses that you could choose from.
Yeah.
Now you've got mixed it in with the women and the all abilities.
Mm-hmm.
How much harder is it to actually find
a
course or two courses?
Well, it's not that. Sometimes it's a challenge. In Sydney, it's a challenge getting two courses, because the two courses you want them to be sort of similar in test and condition.
Right.
You know, you don't want one soft course and one firm course if you can help it. I remember when we first had this together with we played at Kingston Heath in Victoria, and there was a paranoia from the women's side. They thought that we were going to set the golf courses up so hard for the guys that the women wouldn't be able to play it.
Yeah.
So I was dealt all these cards that, you know, it was really quite remarkable that they thought I was out to just absolutely tear them apart, which I wasn't.
Embarrass them, yeah.
Yeah, because that's not what we're about, is it? We don't want to do that because it won't look good on TV. It won't be good for sponsors. The players will all be barking.
Yeah.
So you've got to come to the common thread there somewhere, which we did. And it, because, and I go back to talking about the sand belt, the bunker and the green complexes dictate what happens on the sand belt. No matter what you do around the edges of anything else, that will dictate what happens. So we had a great tournament, I think.
And predominantly on that as well, and we see it at the old course at St Andrews.
Yeah.
The weather plays a massive part.
Well, yeah, and you might remember that, I don't know whether you do, but on the last day, I had to set up the course at Victoria quite safe because we had a strong northerly forecast that last day. I think it was for about 40k winds from the north. Now, that's a strong wind, and especially from north on the sand belt, it's pretty tough. Tough for every player, men, women, whatever. So we had to play, you know, use the safety valve in that on that last day.
Yep.
And I think they shot 14 under. Maronk, I think, won with 14 under. And I think Berha, the girl.
Eight,
I think 8 or 10.
Yeah.
You know, so they still played nicely on a proper challenging golf course.
Yep.
10 or 14 under, 15 under. So all of those numbers, they're good numbers to have for a winning score.
When you're doing the little things like the hole locations.
Yep.
what are you mainly focusing on? Like, if you had like three things or five things that you're sort of mainly focused on to create a holocation, what would those main ones be?
Well, number one is the wind.
Okay.
The slope, the wind, the speed of the green, the firmness of the greens.
Yeah.
The club that you would normally hit in. Now, this is one of the other challenges. Where the men will hit a wedge in, I can tighten that pin right up because they're coming in there with lob wedge and
yep.
sand wedge. But the girls might be coming in with six irons.
Yeah.
Right. So now where should I give them another meter? And that sort of thing. So does that then, what does that do for the men's side of the tournament? They think, well, why isn't that pin tighter? On a short par five where they can drive a par five, that pin should be tight into a nice small par five green. But for the women, they might not be able to get to it for two.
Yeah, so you're making sure that the men don't get the 22 under, which is just a putt-off.
Well, yeah, or 25 under.
But
yeah.
You're making sure the women at least get under par.
Correct, and that's what the request is.
Yeah.
So from that side, it's a balance now.
And so with that kind of thing, you go, I've got a tight hole location that I want. Do you move the woman up and play around with their actual length so they are hitting a wedge in or something
like
that?
Well, if you can, yes. But okay. Here's one of the other sides to this, is if I move the women up,
yep.
there's got to be a tee to move them up to,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
And if I'm going to move them up and I've got to have signage with them,
yep.
is that signage going to interfere with the guys that are yeah. behind them?
Yep.
So from a TV aspect, that's all got to align as well. So you just can't move people up and back like there's a few things involved in it that you've got to be careful with.
Do you go in prior to the tournament and say, oh,
yes,
the answer we need a new tee there?
Yeah, no, I never try to do that.
Okay.
I never try to do that. I try to cope with what we've got because that's, most of the time that's is cost that's not really
It's going to be there for 1 week. And
it's going to be there for 1 week.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we've tried to get away from, you know, these demands of just for 1 week stuff. Okay. Now, the club might put, like they did at Victoria, they chose to put a new tee on the sixth hole, back and left.
Okay.
Now, I chose not to use that because the trees on the left, further up,
had grown out,
it encroached somewhat, yeah. and with the wind prevailing, wind coming off the left, the men...
Straight in the rough on the right.
Correct. So that, all those things
yeah.
are things that you've got to weigh up as well.
Yeah.
So it's quite a bit to it on the way holes play,
yep.
on how you want to play. Like players, men hitting shorter irons into greens, those greens, we'd really normally, when the men's have been only, we'd have them like three from the edge. We'd have them nice and tight.
Yep.
You know, good tight pins, and if you, you know, risk reward, if you miss that, you've got a bunker shot, you won't get up and down.
Yeah.
Right? But if you hit a great shot, you'd be rewarded, obviously. Yep. But, you know, when the women are playing, it's not that easy to make it as fair for them if you put it tight like yep. that.
Now we'll come. I want to talk about the, you know, the 35 years that you've been involved and the distance that the ball goes.
Yes.
But just before that, I know that having talked to you previously, you know, sometimes it's not just the golf course that you're focusing on when you are, you know, trying to work out where the tournament is going to play. I know car parking can be a massive part of it.
Yep. And well, car parking's a huge part. You know, public transport's a huge part yep. now. And that's changed somewhat over the years because everybody used to just park in the streets and go and get a ticket. Well, now with the numbers increasing, there's more cars, so there's less parking, obviously, yep. or they're parking further away. So we've had to...
And there's more high-density properties yeah. where... Other people who live there and don't care about golf.
Yeah, correct.
Are like, well, you can't just park in the street.
Well, that's right. Then that's why they get the council onto it, so that they block all the parking.
Yeah.
See, so now you've got to park further away, or we've got to get you another oval or put on more buses from the local railway station. Yeah,
primary school, whatever.
Primary schools, everything. Use every bit of space you can get your hands on. So, yeah, those they're all challenges.
I mean, we're going to live in a couple of weeks. And, you know, it's at the Grange. It's the second year it held at the Grange. And it's fantastic because they've got two courses.
Correct.
So they can use one course and park on the other one.
Yeah, well, that's one of the luxuries that they've got.
Yeah.
But if you were playing over the road at Cooyonga,
yeah.
like, it's very tight there. It's like, so tight. You'd have to start thinking about the airport parking and all that, where the big Target Factory. Yeah.
Well, you ran a women's tournament. Women's Open there.
Yeah, and yeah, so different courses have different assets, if you like. What might be a great asset, like 36 holes at Grange, which is fantastic, it somewhere else might have an even better asset on one course. So it depends. It depends.
So I mentioned the length of the ball. Yeah. How are you, you're seeing the length of the ball change how you do your course setup?
Well, obviously we try and stretch the guys out as far as we can now because they're just bombing it.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the name of the game now. Every young player that you talk to, they're not really that interested in the strategies of where you want to hit it. Now, there's probably the perfect spot, but when they get on that tee and put that tee in the ground, 9 out of 10 of them are just launching. It seems to me now that they're just launching the ball. Hit it as far down there as they can get it, and they won't. If they get it as far down as they can, they're going to have hardly anything in their hand to hit into the green with. Yeah. And so if they're going in with sand, iron, log wedge or whatever, they're generating more spin than what by laying back here at a perfect spot, so to speak. So that side of the game, I think, has changed significantly, certainly over the last 5 years. The ball's going too far, in my view, in everybody's view by the sound of it. And they're not doing justice to these great courses.
Which is, think back from where the whole location is. Where do I have to be in the fairway, hitting my shot off the tee?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we've seen Augusta has lengthened their course, extreme.
Oh, yeah.
Because of they were hitting wedges into 13 and wedges into 15 and stuff like that.
Dramatic. They're going to pull it back further.
Yeah.
They're only, they've just bought more. I think they've bought the golf course behind now.
Yeah,
so they'll stretch that 13th hole out probably by another 50 metres.
Yeah.
We're getting to the corner is going to be the challenge.
Yeah.
Not going through into the trees.
Yeah.
That's been the chance. It'll be getting to the corner where you can actually see the green.
And it used to be that you try and, if you could shape your tee shot around perfectly, you might have a 7-iron in.
Yeah, correct.
But now you'd be down here and you have to try and shape your 3-wood over a raised creek.
Correct, which back in the day they used to have to do.
Yeah.
They used to have to do, but the ball just went so far over the last 20 years that it's changed the dynamic completely on playing that hole.
Yeah.
That's one hole.
Yeah, and a lot of courses. I mean, I mentioned the old course. The old course, if it doesn't blow, it's what Cam Smith win with there, 23, 24, something like that.
Well, it's the weather. It's just, we speak about the length of fairways, like the Australian Open last year, the fairways were 6 millimetres long. Well, back in the late 80s when we were first in Europe, the fairways in Europe were 12 millimetres. And here in Australia, they were 12 millimetres long.
Right.
So if you just imagine if you've got a firm, fast fairway running on 6 millimetres versus a slightly damper fairway at 12 millimetres, there's probably a pretty fair significance of difference.
Yeah.
Isn't there?
How
far the ball's going to roll.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's why this launching, they want to carry. It's all about carrying.
Yeah.
Right, they're not trying to hit these boring shots, these lower boring turning over shots. They're trying to launch it, get that thing in the air. It'll fly miles.
And even if they're in the rough, they can still
get
control.
They don't care. They can hit that lob wedge.
Yeah.
And they're going to generate spin with the lob wedge more so, aren't they? So it's the game's changing.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I don't like Kaikuya, Kaikuya dampening effect.
Yep.
The ball doesn't go as far, and a 6,000 meter course with Kaikuya probably plays longer than a 6,500 meter course. It's
Cooch.
Got Cooch.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. That's why in Sydney on a lot of the courses in Sydney are Kaikuya because more prevalent up there, but we don't have a lot of it here in Melbourne.
No. No, well, it's seen as a terrible grass, but
they've. They use that Primo now, that new chemical, Primo, and it's when they use it now and it ties it together tighter, and as you mow it and it grows tighter and it's not as dense, it's a fantastic surface.
Yeah, right.
When they really use it, it's awesome.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another thing, there's nothing in the rule book here talks about any kind of grass condition and what you're thinking about when you're setting up a golf course.
Yeah.
I mean, even just going from Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria, the three different predominantly three different types of grass that you
correct.
Get.
Correct.
You know, if you go all the way up the Cairns, you're going to have your tropical grasses.
Yeah, yeah.
Come all the way down here, you're going to have your couch. Yeah, goes so dormant in the winter.
Yeah. We have so many cool season grasses down here.
Yeah.
You know, where everything's obviously further north, looks after the humidity.
Yeah.
Humidity looks after it.
So, you've got to be thinking about that. You're planning in like six months out.
Right.
And you're going, oh, well, the grass looks like this now. But when come December,
you'll
be cutting that three times a day almost.
Correct, correct. So, you know, it's wear and tear. Even like your tees. You know your tees are going to get all chopped up, so you've got to get everybody off them and save them. And then you're working out your signage. And
That's one thing, tees. I don't understand players who want to play off the middle of the tee during their practice round. Like that 5 metre difference. We put them out the back.
Back right in corner.
To save the tee for the tournament.
Yeah.
And then you'll see some dickhead go and hit a big divot out of the middle, you know, I need to work out my club distance. It's like, mate, you're 5 metres, you're a professional golfer. Save the tee so it looks nice on TV, you know, on Thursday, Friday.
Well, maybe they just don't care as much as we do.
No, maybe they just...
Maybe they don't.
Yeah, attitude.
Yeah.
So I mentioned Augusta before, and I know this because this is one of the first times I heard your name was when I used to be coached by Alan Rose, who's a really good friend of yours, in Dunedin at his Sharpie indoor coaching room. And I was there in 2002, I think it was, and a fax came through around Masters time.
Yeah.
And he looks at it and he goes, oh, it's a scorecard from Trevor Herden, who's just played at Augusta.
Yep.
And to me, you know, I was young back then, and I didn't sort of realise, have too much understanding of, you know, how big the majors are. But, you know, now, 20 years on, like that's crazy. You have actually played at Augusta and refereed at Augusta.
Yeah, we did.
How did that all come about?
Well, we the chairman of Augusta tournament was a guy by the name of Will Nickerson, and he came to the Players' Championship in the British Open, and we really got to know him well. He worked those tournaments as an invited guest, and over the years we just got on great with him, and he could see that we were reasonably good at our trade. We kept up to date with the modern practices and demands of players and what they expected, etc. Whereas at Augusta, they had all their members used to do the rules in the green jackets. You might remember standing by Ray's Creek and all that in green jackets. Well, they were members of Augusta.
Yeah.
All USGA qualified, etc. But they were an older group of people.
Yeah.
They were getting older. So Will decided that instead of waiting for something to happen, he'd get some younger people in there who were quite good, etc.
Professional referees.
And he invited four of us initially.
Okay.
So there was myself, John Paramore, who's unfortunately died a couple of years back.
Yeah.
Mike Shea from the US Tour.
Yeah.
And Theo Manyama from South Africa. We were the first four professional referees to be invited to Augusta.
Yeah.
So we went over there and that's how we got involved. And since then it's grown, like the door's open very, very wide for the world to go to Augusta now. So that's how all that unfolded. And they invited me if you're an international guest, and you were, they used to invite international media and the referees, some of them, not all of them, just some of them, to go and play on the Monday following the tournament.
Yeah, wow.
And I birdied 12 the first time I played. How's that?
So was that date... So you started, I think you said 6 years ago?
I started in 90, I think the first one I went to was 93 or 94.
Okay.
And I probably played it 4 or 5 years later, maybe 2000, 2001?
Yeah.
Might have been.
Well, that year that I saw that fax come through was 2002, I'm pretty sure, because that was the first year that I was in Dunedin.
Right.
And so that, and it came through and it's true.
It might have been 2002.
And so, you know, we've talked about sort of the setup of the golf course, but in your mind, you know, do you see like a massive difference between the amateur and the professional game from a rules point of view?
Well, there are some differences, but not a great deal. The biggest difference, I think, with the professional game and the amateur game is the infrastructures. You know, there's just so much infrastructure around now at the regular tournaments. You know, we've put Augusta aside, but if you talk about other big tournaments and other normal pro, there's so many grandstands and TV stuff, and there's so much gear. And now the villages, for example, the villages, every tournament will have a major village probably, but then they'll have another satellite village out, you know, on the front nine somewhere.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I just say that, like, putting the Australian Open as an example. We have that big one in the centre of the Australian Golf Club, and then you have a satellite one out further out at 15 and 16. So, you know, I think there's just so much more, and there's so many more people want to get involved in golf now. They want to be part of it. So if somebody wants to come and sponsor and be part of it and, you know, exhibit whatever they've got, you've got to make room for it or find room for it, you know. So then you add that on there. Then the village...
Another TIO.
It gets bigger and bigger. And then there's more exposure. Yeah. What are they going to get for that? And all the rest of the stuff. So I think all of that stuff just, it grows and it's growing. And, you know, last year at the Australian Open, I keep using this, but we had such big crowds at the Australian Open last year that we had to get in another 4 food trucks overnight to feed them. Because they've been out of food.
That's very important.
It's vital.
If someone's there for 10 hours.
And they've got to have some hydration.
Especially if they've got kids.
Correct. So all of these things, which is an unknown, and because we don't pre-sell all our tickets, you can rock up and buy at the gate. You know, that's a lot of people. There was a huge crowd there, especially on that last day.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. So I don't see, you know, going back, we don't have tee signage on every tee. We don't have green side signage at amateur events. We don't have TV towers behind greens. We don't have cabling everywhere. We don't have, you know, there's all those things that we don't have at most amateur events. Now we'll have a little bit of on the first and tenth tee. We'll have a few flagpoles and all that stuff, which is fine. And dressed up looks great as well. It looks nice. But the amount of stuff is not even in the same ballpark.
That's actually really... I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, we see these hard cards, you know, whether it's the LIV or the Asian Tour, and you're thinking, I mean, those are just out of the book. They are rules of golf, but there are a few local rules, but a lot of the local rule and a lot of our rulings are based around signage and TV towers and grandstands,
correct,
the TIOs, which, you know... The reality is that is the biggest, as you said, that's the biggest difference.
And you might remember, like, up until probably 10 years ago, we never used to let players go either side.
Yeah.
We used to, well, you've hit it in there, sir.
Yeah.
You know?
Get what you get.
You get what you get. Nearest point, that's where you've got to go. But now we give them either side because we've got so much and we jam it. And in most cases, a lot of cases, it would be so unfair to force a player to go to one side and not allow him to get to the other.
Yeah.
We'd absolutely crucify him. And that's not, you know, I spoke earlier about having the proper playing of the game.
Yeah.
Right. Well, forcing people in under trees to take relief from a TV tower is never the proper playing of the game, is it?
Yeah. Well, we had one of the in Macau 4 weeks ago where, you know, we'd built a grandstand this far, well, this actually, literally this far from the green.
Yeah, a metre.
Right? A metre from the green.
Yeah.
And the player's ball went over into some absolute rubbish, but it was surrounded by a path. It had the grandstand there, so we'd made the whole area, and it looked like the most nicest, generous drop.
Yeah.
But it was just the fact that, well, we've put this grandstand here, and, you know, that's taken away your option of chipping out sideways, and it's done all this, you know. So we've made it as easy as possible behind it because of all these abnormal things through a golf course.
Structures, Yeah, and that's, you never want to force, and it's like marking a piece of GUR. You should always think about where you're going to force a player to drop before you mark the GUR.
Yeah.
Right? Because, again, you don't want to force a player. He's got to take his nearest point and one club length out of the GUR, right? So, but if that's going to put him under a bush and he's going to be unplayable, basically, that is not right. We've got to narrow it down somewhere. Get him out of the GUR, and if there's another piece, then we deal with that as another scenario.
Yeah.
So always be, I would say to you, your friends. You know, always be careful what you mark, where you're going to mark it before you do it.
And similar with, you know, penalty area. You mark a penalty area. I know the penalty area, you shouldn't have hit it in there, but when he takes the drop, or she takes the drop, and the slope is like this.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you might as well just mark it up on the top so at least pace of play, we're not having them drop, place until the ball comes to the rest.
Yeah. And they're coming out under penalty anyway, so it's not, they're not getting a free kick.
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
They're already taking an extra shot for
It's funny you talk about hard cards. It's how, I remember that scenario with Faldo.
Yeah.
That's how we started with hard cards, because Mr. Dunhill wrote to me after that tournament that he sponsored the Alfred Dunhill with Faldo when they had to disqualify him.
Yeah.
He said it'd be great if all the tours could get on the same page with the local rules. And from that point, we all got together and we said, well, that's right. So that's why each, on back of these hard cards, you'll see something in a, should probably have a
little box.
A little box. Yeah, a little box. So,
and it says the following apply on Asian Tour competitions but may not apply on other major tours.
Correct. So every tour did their own hard card and specified what was strictly on their tour and maybe not on others.
So prior to that, which was about 95, I think you said.
Yeah, yeah.
Prior to that, you just turned up at the tournament and the members would know that that is the rules that they play under, because they play under those rules all the time. And you just add a couple of extra ones as local to that tournament.
Correct.
Local to that
supplementaries,
course.
Yeah.
Right. But the main guys, if it's a member from another tour, he's coming thinking, oh, well, this is the main league, what I play under there. And then they should be basically the same. That must be a rule of golf.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's local to
Correct.
That.
That's why that was introduced.
It's about 95.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it is.
The hard cap.
Yeah. Like Pickett, we'd go to the UK and the European Tour would always have, you know, like we never had that metal fencing.
Yeah.
Well, that, because it was only really in the British Open and major European events. Like if you were in four club lengths of it, you could come back in over the other side of
that
it.
That cycle, the bicycle.
Bicycle fencing, yeah. So all of these things that came in and they had to put them in a separate square.
Yeah.
So that as soon as a player from another part of the world came and he got that card, he could see what was different to this tour.
Yeah, wow.
But a good move, wasn't it?
Yeah, great move. I mean, I'm thinking of little ones like, the Open Championship used to just play no embedded balls anywhere. But other tours would actually say, oh, well, you get free relief in the
closely mark.
In the closely mark.
Yeah.
Whatever it was. And then, the PGA Championship now, they don't have the one ball policy.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the major tours still have the one ball policy.
Yeah. Yeah.
One ball rule.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But it's helping the player out.
What have you, are there, you know, so we've had a major, major rules change 2019. Are there rules there that you go, that you have actually been, you know, lobbying for change for the last 20 years?
Well, I think the ball moving on the putting green has probably been the best thing ever.
Yeah.
There's one more that I think.
And it's still so simple now. Like, it's like no one was trying to sort of cheat the system in the first place, were they?
No. I don't think so, no. No. No, it makes, now that it's in, it's,
it makes a lot of sense.
Everybody says, well, God, that makes sense. Why didn't they do that years ago?
Right.
So, like, it's just some of the things and some of the poor players have been really, well, you'd say they've been hardly done by it when you look at it today.
Can you remember, I remember this one, can you remember, what was his name, Jeff someone, 2004, when? Augusta Masters? Were you at 2004?
No, I wasn't at 2004.
Jeff Maggot.
Yeah.
Hits the ball into the bunker face.
Yeah.
Comes back, hits him.
Right.
Two-shot penalty.
Ball in motion, stopped or deflected by the player.
Accidentally, doesn't matter, two-shot penalty.
Yeah.
They changed that rule 2008, I think, to one-shot penalty.
Right.
2019.
Gone.
Or it might have even been earlier than that.
Yeah. Well, it's the same as hitting your equipment now,
isn't it?
That's right. That's right. You know, the bloke golfer leaves his bag up on the hill and walks back 120 yards to the tee.
Yeah.
And he has, it's a terrible tee shot. It just happens to hit his bag and he's left. So, yeah.
No,
there's one rule that I don't know why, and you might have a great answer for this. I said might. But why can't we relieved from a boundary fence?
I don't have a great answer.
The reason I say that is that we, in these amateur championships that we play around the country, there's so many facilities, like greenkeepers' facilities and stuff, internally, right, within the course itself. They have the fence around them. Yeah. They say, oh, it's an out-of-bounds fence, right? Now, we can change it to an obstruction if we want. But nine times each week, the player, the member, plays that as an out-of-bounds fence.
Yeah.
Now, some of the greens roll straight back down into the boundary fence.
Yeah.
So if you miss a green, trickle off, and you're going to roll straight down there up against the boundary fence.
Yeah.
Now you automatically penalise one shot because you're going to have to take an unplayable to hit it.
Yeah.
Probably. So why? If
I don't have a.
I know. I know. But a good answer. The more you delve into the little things.
Yeah.
Like I remember when I first started back in 89, we were never allowed to drop over, through or under an obstruction to determine the nearest point.
Right.
Now the nearest point, if you go and say, you know, someone's, for example, if you had a par 3 tee near the green that you're just playing, there's a fixed seat.
Yeah.
On the part back of the tee, which there are a lot of courses. If I hit it in behind that, I was going the other way, I couldn't go over, through or under it to determine the nearest point. I just had to stay on that side of it and get to a point where I wouldn't hit it.
Which was no nearer the hole.
No nearer the hole or anything, but I couldn't hit it, or still too close to it, hit it over it or whatever. So, but they're just the little rules that were in place at the time.
See, it's funny because the word ding in the, you know, for getting relief is you are allowed to measure in over or under or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But I never knew why they had actually had to say that.
Yeah.
And now I know why. It's because back then you were in accident.
So if you think about car paths.
Yeah.
If you were taking relief from a car path, you weren't allowed to go over the car path to determine the nearest point, even though you might have been left-handed or whatever that was going to be. You couldn't go over it to determine the nearest point. You had to stay on whatever side you were on.
Right.
I can't even
comprehend that.
Yeah, well, if you go back and get some of the older books and have a look, you're not allowed to cross over, through or under to determine the nearest point of relief.
Wow. I did not know. Have you got any other gems? So those are some of the changes that you've seen. Yeah. Are there any that you'd still like to change? So obviously boundary fence, possibly.
Yeah. I don't get the reasoning behind the boundary fence. And I think it may have come from people moving stakes, the same as if sometimes with penalty area stakes. But even
when it's a fence that's a chicken wire fence, it's pretty hard to move that kind of thing.
Yeah, but the player hasn't hit it out of bounds, but he can't play a shot.
One of the funny ones that I've probably mentioned on the podcast before, you know, when I was a green stick in the rules, you know, I thought a fence and a wall were the same thing. But that's not true. Yeah. A fence was measured from the inside and a wall was measured from the outside. And when JP told me that, I was like, why?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Oh, no.
It has to be beyond the wall, whereas the fence is just
inside.
I know.
Done. But anyway, we're making progress, I think. Yep. I think they've come a long way in this particular, these last lot of changes.
Now, but without being too controversial, do you think they're dumbing it down too much? Do you think one of the great things about golf was that you actually had to do some kind of study and learn your rules to make sure you weren't? Or do you think, you know, that's just a barrier to the game of golf?
I think that there's so many rules in golf, so many circumstances, so many things that happen in a game of golf, or could happen, right? Yeah. Whereas if you're playing basketball, there's not that much can happen, is there? So to get people to try and learn so much of this, I think they've got to keep dummying it down a bit.
Okay.
I think they've gone a long way with the drop rule. Yeah. Remember when we first started, I remember dropping over your shoulder, then with arms straight out. And now we're dropping at the knee next, and that's every 10 years. I think they've changed one of them. So where's the next one going to be? If they're going to change this one,
has to be
Do you ever think it'd be a place?
The funny thing is, you know, Anthony Kim, you know, hadn't been playing golf for the last 10, 12 years.
Yeah.
And he's now on LIV. And the first time he went to drop the ball in Saudi Arabia, his first tournament, he went to drop for all of that. I mean, it's changed 6 years.
Yeah, it's been changed.
But he doesn't watch golf, hasn't played golf, doesn't know anything about the rules changes.
Yeah.
And he went to drop like that, and the referee said, well, hey, hang on, that's from the knee. He goes, when did that change?
Yeah. Well, I think most people, well, obviously other than him maybe, but most people now know that. I think they're going the right way. I think if they can just make more, if they can make more things happen more easily, and that they can align with what also happens and it's similar to another rule instead of having a totally separate...
Yeah, consistency.
Yeah, consistency in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're going to... You know, it's like going back on your line from a dropping out of a water hazard. Yellow penalty area. All that stuff. And I think one of the good things really is the area. What do you call it? Designated area?
The relief area.
So the ball's
got has to stay.
It's got to stay.
That's the best one.
Whether it be a dropping zone, whether it be within two club lengths, within one club length. Now that is all the same, right?
You used to be able to drop within two club lengths.
Yeah. Roll up to two.
Roll up to two. So then you got to get your club out to measure from, where did it hit?
Somewhere there.
Grab a club.
Yeah.
And go, now which spot did it hit? Is it still within the two?
But then on the other hand, if that player got that wrong, there's another rule that says we're going to penalise him two shots for playing from the wrong place. Right. So we're asking him to do the right thing and follow that, but you screw up and you get another two.
And you would have seen this so often that especially the camera would have been on Nick Fowler. The camera would have been on Greg Norman.
Correct, yeah.
So they were, if they did anything wrong...
They were seen.
Whereas, you know, the guy that was just made the cut, no one's seeing him.
No. But that's always been the case, isn't it? So,
as of recently, you know, I know LIV are putting this in very soon.
Yeah.
Every shot will be seen.
Yeah.
Every shot. It's a lot easier for 54 players.
Yeah.
But every shot, so, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but there could be a mountain of rulings coming.
Oh, yeah.
Very soon.
The tour mightn't be over till Sunday morning.
Where people who shot three over, but he dropped it the wrong way.
Yeah, that's right.
It's going to be interesting. But
let's just put it down to progress. Yeah. I think it's progress. Certainly come a long way. Like, for example, as I talk about, couldn't grow over, through or under.
Yeah.
Now start thinking about what else they had back in the day.
Yeah.
Like, people just, did he measure over, through or under? Well, he went across the back of it like this.
I didn't even know that.
Yes. You can have a look. Man, if you can get some of the old decisions book from way back and have a look, you'll see some of the scenarios. Right. And it'll be quite interesting.
Like, I saw the wording, I just did not know that that's why they had that in there.
Yeah.
No, thank you very much, Trevor, for being an absolute fantastic guest. Yeah, I mean, we could have gone through a few more stories, but you've given me... I've learned so much, and this is one of the podcasts, you know, my own podcast. I've learned so much just from listening to you.
No, it's a pleasure. So, everybody should just keep progressing.
Yeah. I look forward to working with you a lot more too. So,
good on you, mate.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Cheers.
See you. My hand.
I hope you really enjoyed that chat that I had with Trevor Herden. I know that I did. I got a lot out of it. He is a very experienced, very knowledgeable person and knows how to run a golf tournament like the back of his hand. I've got the GRQ OTW 113 for this week, which is in a stroke play competition. Stuart hits their tee shot into a heavily wooded area. Stuart plays a provisional ball under rule 18.3B and it comes to rest in the fairway. They search for the original ball for 1 minute and declare it lost. Stuart then walks over to their provisional ball and accidentally kicks it. He replaces it, but before he plays it, and within 3 minutes of starting the search, a spectator finds Stewart's original ball. He lifts the provisional ball and plays the original ball to the green, then takes two putts and tees off on the next hole. What is Stewart's score for the hole? As if Stewart would have spectators. Hope you have a good crack of that. Make sure to put your answers on the YouTube after I upload the podcast. And we will be seeing you in the next episode of the Golf Rules Questions podcast. Bye for now.